The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio on KVRF 89.5 in the Mat-Su Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site. You can find all of our episodes over on iTunes. Just search for Dog Works Radio over there, as well as on Facebook and Twitter. We're continuing on with our Iditarod Musher series, and today we're talking to Lev Schwartz. He came in 54th place in this year's race, finishing in 12 days and 6 hours. Lev, how's it going?
Good.
How is things up in Willow?
Muddy.
It is the middle of spring up here, what we're calling breakup, I guess, in terms of our winter up here. It's been a crazy one. We didn't get a lot of snow, which I imagine made training pretty difficult. How did you fare this winter with training?
We weren't that bad off. We are I think we only had to truck dogs for about a week in November when it poured rain and everything got icy. But we've just been barely skating by on our own trails.
Did you have to do a lot of traveling this year for finding trails? I know a lot of people went up to Denali Highway and, you know, drove wherever they could to find that white stuff. How about you?
No, we were our trail system, through diligent maintenance, stayed in good enough shape to use all winter. We did travel a little bit, but some of it was by choice.
Some of it was by choice.
Yeah.
So you attempted Iditarod last year. It was a tough race for everybody, and then you decided to come back and run it this year. Different trail, different conditions, an entirely different winter. If you could compare and contrast a little bit before we get into this year's race compared to the weather debacle and the trail system last year, how was the difference between the two?
Well, I can't compare last year. I mean, I can't tell you what was past where my race ended, but I can tell you that the first 300 miles of this year's Iditarod were exceptionally flat with excellent snow cover and very, very cold, as
right.
opposed to warm, no snow, and very chilly. So, you know, it was almost a completely different race.
That's what I was going to say, was that it was an entirely different race. You know, we've talked to a lot of people here on the show about the very cold temperatures out there. Some were saying minus 30, 40, 50, even 60 degrees below zero. How did you fare through that section of the trail, and how were the dogs?
I actually had no trouble. There were times when I was cold, as I'm sure everybody was, and it was certainly an inconvenience. It was pretty frustrating at times. But I escaped unfrostbitten. And my dogs did really well, actually. I did have an all-female team, leaving Manly, so I didn't have any male parts to worry about. And that's actually, you know, that's just one less concern from a dog care perspective. And my girls were doing just fine in the cold. They were eating and keeping weight. So that's all I could hope for.
You know, that's interesting when you said that. I don't think anybody has mentioned that traveling through that part. For our listeners, can you tell us a little bit about that, what that means when you say that there's one less part that you have to worry about, other than the obvious? What do you have to do for the male dogs compared to not having to do for the females?
Well, the male dogs have their male parts that might need to be protected from the elements when it's that cold. I'm trying to find a way to not say certain words for you. But it's, you know, we put foxtails on, or everybody's got their own system, but it's basically trying to keep the male parts out of the wind, one way or the other. It's just one more thing you have to be aware of out there in that kind of temperature.
Is there a kind of a threshold temperature where those go on automatically, or is it really just condition by condition?
You know, in my yard, we put them on at about 20 below in training. It's one of those things where, okay, so you put it on and you take it off, and it takes you an extra few minutes here and a few minutes there. But the whole freezing of certain things is bad, so I just see it as a preventative measure. It's just easier to do it than to freeze up the dogs.
Right, of course. So heading out with the all-female team there for Manly, how did that work out with you in terms of size? You know, when people think of female dogs, and in particular sled dogs, they often think of the smaller, more petite dogs. Is that kind of a good description of your team, or do you have some real husky-looking females out there?
No, I had a whole bunch of really small girls.
Right.
I had a whole bunch of really small girls, and, yeah, size was an issue. It would have been nice to have some either larger women or big men on my outfit. But, yeah, size was a bit of an issue.
So as you head through the Yukon there and working your way up towards, you know, the last third of the trail, you know, we didn't hear a lot about that on our show. It was either the extreme of the first part of the race or the windy whiteout conditions in the second or in the last third, you know, from Unalakleet on up. How did that that middle section work out for you guys, and did you guys have any issues through there?
Are you talking about the trail from Hooslea to Caltag or to Unalakleet?
Yes.
Well, when I left Hooslea, I think that was the last cold night. And I really had a pretty good trail going to Koyukuk. And then when I ran over to Caltag, it had started. There was a storm that had gone through, deposited a few inches. The wind had sort of made a mess of things, too. So I kind of had a cruddy trail. And I heard the folks behind me had a total whiteout.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just got a weather forecast in Koyukuk, and it seemed like it would be good to just keep on moving. Caltag to Unalakleet was, you know, there was fresh snow there, but there had been teams that had gone after the snow but before me, so I had a nice trail. And I talked to some of those guys after the race, and they said, yeah, well, we had no trail going to Unalakleet. So, you know, in a race with that many teams spread out over that many days, things are going to change, and they change quickly. So
right.
I'm not sure you can get a – you can hear two different reports on the same chunk of trail 2 days apart, and they'll be totally different.
You know, one of the common things that folks do on Iditarod is they mush together with other teams, other mushers. Were you part of that at all, or are you one of those guys that kind of just sets the trail on your own and goes about your way?
I am in the latter camp, and there were a couple times when the timing worked out where I would either leave with somebody or arrive at a camp with somebody. And there was definitely a time leaving Shaktulik when Don Broke and a whole bunch of teams kind of set off together across the Norton Sound. So that was the one time I was traveling with other teams. But no, the rest of the time I just kind of engaged by what my dogs do and don't need. If my dogs needed rest, I gave them more rest. Or if if I thought they needed rest, they got more rest. If I thought they didn't, I might not stay as long as somebody else. So, no, my schedule, well, my lack of schedule and just the way it was running was not based on any other driver in the race.
Do you think that that can be a helpful thing or more of a hindrance for especially rookie mushers when they go out and they say, okay, let's travel together down the trail and, you know, kind of help each other out? Or do you think it's a little bit better to do it on your own and I guess it's one less thing you have to worry about?
Yeah, I'm kind of in the latter camp because I don't think you can ever get two dog teams paced exactly the same. And there's ebbs and flows during a particular run where a dog team might just be going a little bit slower and another it's going a little bit faster, and then an hour later that changes. And I just kind of let dogs do their own thing. So if I was traveling with somebody else, I couldn't do that.
Right.
Give another rookie advice, I would say travel on your own. You know, it's hard to say because I feel quite comfortable being outside on my own for however many days on end. So I have a comfort level. There's no loneliness factor. There's not a fear factor. So if you're comfortable being outside, I say go ahead and travel to what your dogs can do.
So, Lev, you had mentioned that your schedule was relatively fluid. You hear a lot about run-rest schedules, and you're going to go from this checkpoint to that checkpoint and rest 8 hours, et cetera, from a lot of Iditarod mushers. Did you have something pretty set in stone when you left Fairbanks, or like you said, did it just become relatively fluid down the trail and you sort of worked it out on what you and your dogs needed on the way?
It was completely fluid. But the only thing I knew is I would make one run to Nanana and two runs to Manly. And I didn't know how long those runs would take because I had no idea about the trail conditions that they're done in. And my deal was I would just rest as long as it took to run there. So I ended up running straight to Nanana's. It took me 6 hours. I stayed 6 hours. Ran halfway to Manly. It took me 5 hours. It rested 5 hours. And that kind of became the theme almost all the way to the coast for me.
So you just set that relatively fluid schedule and rocked and rolled with it. So if we can talk about the latter part of the race, in particular from White Mountain on in, at that point I assumed you knew that Nome was in sight and you were going to finish and things were looking pretty good for you. What were you feeling at that point? You know, a rookie going to finally make it to the end. What was going through your mind there in that last part of the race?
You know, by that point, I was a little bit bummed out because all I did for the last God knows how many days was drive dogs. And if you ask me at any point in the race, hey, Lev, what are you doing tomorrow? Oh, I'm driving dogs. And what are you doing the day after, Lev? Oh, I'm driving dogs. And then when you leave White Mountain, what are you doing tomorrow? Well, you're not driving dogs.
Right. That's a great point. So you know, I guess it's kind of the thrill of victory there, so to speak. When you were coming down into Nome and you know, past safety and you know the end was in sight. Obviously, you and your dogs felt that anticipation coming along. What was going through your mind that last 25, 30 miles or so? And then, of course, when you crossed over the finish line.
It was when we left safety, you run along the sea ice for a little bit, and then you climb the hill, so you can't really see Nome for a while until you get to the top of the hill. And then from the hill, you come back down and run along the beach there. And when I did see Nome, it was like there's an end to this. You know, I fell into a dog driver schedule in the middle of a long-distance race. I've never done it, so it was kind of neat. But then there's the goal. You know, you've been traveling for God knows or however many days, and obviously I wasn't on a competitive schedule, but there was an end to it. And as somebody that's never run 1,000 miles, it was pretty overwhelming to see the end. I just had all sorts of thought and emotions going through my head all the way along the beach. I was pretty proud of my girls. I was pretty excited to finally do what I've been after for a decade and change. But it's funny, when I did cross the finish line, I was happy. Don't get me wrong, I was very happy. But last couple of miles, I'm like, geez, if I come back and I, if I take this one dog and this other dog, and I won't take that dog and that dog, and I'm going to check and cut the rest here. I mean, you're thinking in your head how much faster you can do this the next time around.
Mm-hmm.
And it's... That was it. I was planning my next Iditarod as I was finishing this one up.
I hear that a lot. Lev, if we could, before we talk about the finish and what was going through your guys' mind at that point, if we could step back a little bit. You had mentioned just a second ago about that decade leading up to it. And here it comes, within the next couple of hours, all of that work is going to be behind you, so to speak, when you finally finish the race. Can you tell us about how you got started and what it took in terms of moving to Alaska and all of that to get ready to run this race in particular and chase that crazy Iditarod dream and that belt buckle? What did it take to get you there?
Some people, I started with one dog on the East Coast, a pet dog. His name was Ollie. And then one way or the other, through happenstance, I got hooked into dog driving. Then I got another dog and another dog and another dog. And, what I was doing at the time would be considered the bottom level of recreational. Kind of got bored at work and decided to spend a winter handling in Alaska. Stayed with the Norrises while JP and Kari were training a rendezvous team, and that was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. They're good people to work for, and they kind of showed me what that kind of dog racing is about, but distance was my thing. I wanted to run the Iditarod, and I bought some dogs. I moved back to New England. Kept working, la-di-da, ran some mid-distance races there. In fact, at one point, I was qualified for Iditarod before they had changed the requirements. And, we looked at our team and said, we could truck them up next year and run it. And I'm looking at a bunch of seven-year-old dogs. And it's like, let's breed up another team and let's just move to Alaska. And my wife said, yeah, this sounds like a completely reasonable idea, Lev. Have you thought this out? No, but I did it anyway. So we got here. I requalified with, the dogs we have now. And then obviously we had a rough start when I did it last year, but this year we got it done. It was a lot of work leading up to it. We chose to do it with our own dogs. We didn't have to. It probably would have been easier not to from a logistics perspective. It was far more rewarding to do it with my own dogs. And I tend to pick the route of greatest resistance for some reason. So it was, it really was. I mean, most of that was a homemade team, not all of it. But they were all dogs that I had trained that season, both years. It was fun. It took a lot of work to get there. It took an ungodly amount of money. But it was kind of, it was a homemade effort, and that felt pretty good.
I bet. So Lev, you finally finished, as we said, 12 days, 6 hours, and some change there. You got your team to Nome, and there's that classic picture that was posted all over Facebook of you sitting there with that smile on your face, holding a holding a bottle of beer. Tell us what was going through your mind there at that finisher banquet when they finally called your name and said you are an Iditarod finisher.
Yeah, that was one of the happier moments of my life.
Awesome.
It was. It's Iditarod mushers. I can't speak for the Quest, but I know that Iditarod mushers are a pretty tight-knit community, and it was like being welcomed into a club where you had to, you know, earn your initiation in the way in. And it just, everybody on the trail that I came across was friendly, outgoing, willing to help. I helped people when I could. It's just a super friendly community out there on the trail. Can't speak for the front half of the race because I never saw the front half of the race, but I'm sure those folks are just as nice. And it was, it's nice being part of the club.
Very cool. So you guys finished up, did very well. How did you feel, you know, when you finished where you did at 54th? I'm sure everybody would like to finish a little bit better. You know, everybody's wanting to do their best. How did you feel with where you placed at 54th?
Well, like I said, I was planning on how to run it faster as I wasn't even done with this one. I learned so much about what it takes to do it by doing it. I could count the massive mistakes that I had made in my head. I could have done much better with the same dogs I was driving had I had the experience, but there's no way I could have done that much better without having had the experience. And I think the major thing is that, you know, that race put a couple dogs into the proper frame of mind, and then it put a couple more dogs into the proper frame of mind, and it put a couple more dogs into the proper frame of mind. And I think if I took those same dogs here, I think they would do much better, even if I kept making all the same mistakes. It seems like that race builds dogs.
They truly mature in front of your eyes there. Lev, can you tell
you
us a little bit about
it.
Your
it's
dogs?
Amazing.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, I said you can see it happening. It's really quite amazing when a dog just decides, you know what? I am an Iditarod dog. And sometimes it happens in Ruby or Galena or Unalakleet or whatever, but the dogs just get better. It's amazing.
They get better. So can you tell us a little bit about your team, how old they are? You'd mentioned that they were all girls. Where do they come from in terms of lines? You know, a lot of talk is that you're running primarily Siberians. Is that the case? Tell us a little bit about your team.
I think the average age on that dog team was 6. I had quite a few girls in that team that I raised myself. They were Siberians. They're mostly out of dogs that I had bought from the Norrises, not that generation, but the one after. I had a couple dogs from Bob Kalupach on that team, younger girls. And then I had a couple of filler Alaskans on that team, too. They're dogs that were hand-me-downs from other drivers that did really well for me. And I had... Yeah, it was kind of a random collection of dogs out of the yard. There was a number of dogs that I wanted to take, but I couldn't due to injury before the race. It wasn't supposed to be an all-female team. But it seemed like I had just kind of had a rash of dings and dents on a whole bunch of my boys, you know. So I would have liked to start with last year's team. I thought last year we brought a much better team to the race, but... You know, that's the ebb and flow of training, and I got what I got, and I drove what I got.
Right, and you know, like you said, that's sort of how the chips fall, if you will. So we have about 5 minutes left, Lev, and I want to make sure that we get in websites and how people can follow you, et cetera, at the end. But, of course, everybody always wants to know what's next. What's happening with you? Are you planning on it again? I know it's only been about a month or so since the finish. What are you thinking about?
I am thinking about puppies right now. I have some. I need some more. I think we're going to take a couple years away from the race to recover financially. Two Iditarods have left me deep in the hole, and even though we didn't finish one of them, our money went regardless, you know.
Right.
So we're left with some pretty steep bills to cover, so I got to claw my way out of that hole. And as soon as I do, I'd really like to bring a team of two-year-olds in a couple years and drive them to Nome on a nice and easy schedule and make them Iditarod dogs, and then come back with the same team when they're 3, 4, and 5 and see if we really can be more competitive with that dog, that type of dog. But it requires that we bring in a bunch of dogs, which is really a lot of fun, but also expensive. But not quite as expensive as Iditarod.
Right. So, this group of pups that you have, I know I saw on Facebook there that you have a batch right now. Pretty much training will start for those guys relatively soon if you're thinking about running them as two-year-olds. You're going to have to stay on a relatively tight schedule when these guys are growing up. Is that right?
I don't know. It really depends on when we can get more pups on the ground and start training a whole group together. Because, you know, these pups right now, they're all 5 weeks old. So their harness breaking is at least 8 or 9 months away.
Right.
That gives me quite a bit of time to sort things out. We're probably going to have a really easy yearling year for them. And then when they're two, I mean, we're looking at a few years down the road. And I'll probably enter some mid-distance races with the adults that I have next season, but it certainly won't be Iditarod. But, yeah, the focus is on a new generation of dogs.
Very cool. So, Lev, a couple of minutes left here. Your website is teamollie.com. It's spelled OLIE.com. How else can other people find you? Do you have a Facebook page? Do you accept that sort of thing? And what do you do? What do you do in the off season? Are you working? Are you in construction? What do you do?
Well, I'm going to correct you really quickly. There's two L's in Ollie.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. And you can find us on Facebook by putting in Team Ollie as two words, and I'm sure we'll pop right up. So if anybody wants to get in touch, that's the best way. If you want to follow along, I think the website is being updated like once every 2 years by me. So basically poorly, but the Facebook page is far more current. Yeah, I am starting work tomorrow morning in construction, and I am looking forward to getting a paycheck again because I need it. So that's going to be my summer.
A good sight.
It is. It's really exciting to finally be gainfully employed and make money instead of spending it hand over fist.
Right. I hear you there. So Lev Schwartz is our guest today here on Mushing Radio. Lev, anything else in closing? You want to thank any sponsors or any individuals before you go? You know, it's time to give them a shout out if you want.
I do. I would love to thank all the private individuals as well as Underdog Feeds that have donated money to allow us to do this. I know that this is hard-earned money for people, and I really feel grateful and honored that people are willing to throw us contributions, both private and business. And thank you all to whoever's listening. I'd like to thank my wife for putting up with me for years and years with me trying to get this done. We had a phenomenal dog handler the last 2 years. Her name is Allison. I don't think I could have gotten there without her because I'm not organized and she is. So it was as much her efforts as it was mine that got the team to Nome. And it just seems to be a history of women in my life making my life easier, both dogs and people.
That's what I was going to say, including those on the line for sure.
Yeah, it's just, this has been a race for me. It's been, this year has just been a race of women making things happen.
Awesome. Good stuff, Lev. We're about out of time. I appreciate you being on today, and good luck at your next adventure, whether that be a couple of years on the trail or whatever you do. We'll make sure we stay in touch, okay?
Robert, thank you for having me on.
Thank you. Lev Schwartz is our guest today. We'll talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.